Today we're still in the book of Acts, chapter 19, verse 23, through chapter 20, and verse 1. So far in the book of Acts, we've seen the gospel really preached well. In chapter 2, remember, 3,000 people saved. There was some resistance from the leaders of the Jews, but for the most part, no real persecution. Peter and John were in prison. They got flogged for it. No massive persecution. Then in Acts 8, the Samaritans received the gospel. Again, great rejoicing. Philip went down to the desert, and there he found an Ethiopian and led him to the Lord. He went on to his home rejoicing. Acts chapter 10, Cornelius, the Gentile, heard the word, received it. So all of this is to say, well, it's going to be great. Everything's going to be real fine. We're going to preach the word. Everybody's going to love us. Well, it doesn't work that way all the time. We saw Paul, of course, in Acts 16, in Philippian jail, flogged and in stocks, and the Lord did a great miracle there. But now, in this place, we have a whole town. The whole city erupts against the preaching of the gospel. So what do you do when persecution comes? Well, let's see what Paul did, and then we'll find out maybe how we can adopt that to our own selves. In the first place, we see in verses 23 and 24 of Acts 19, the reason for the riot. Objection of the craftsmen. They're the ones who brought the riot forth. And the reason for that, first reason, is that their riches were threatened. You see this in your bulletin. Please follow along. And by the way, we're going to have at the end, open up that thing, I'll tell you when, and we'll open up that double sheet there, and we'll talk about that as well. But here we are. The riches are threatened. Their livelihood. It says in verse 23, and about that time, there arose a great commotion about the way, the church. For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Diana, brought no small profit to the craftsmen. He called them together, that is the craftsmen, with the workers of similar occupation and said, men, you know that we have our prosperity by this trade. This is our whole livelihood is threatened by this. And back in verse 24, just before this, in verse 19, he said, patient believers had burned their pagan books of magic. And considering the price of that, 50,000 pieces of silver, there must have been also some gold in there, some silver in there, some precious metals along with the books. In any case, they had done this already there in Ephesus. And in verse 25, all of these affected were union people. There was a union. They had unions way back there. And they had a union together with all these people who had the trade making these images of Diana, the Ephesians, for the worship of Diana in the city. And so their riches were affected that way. Also, their religion was affected, verse 26 and 27. It says, moreover, you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but throughout almost all Asia, this Paul, apostle, has persuaded and turned away many people, saying that they are not gods which are made with hands. Paul apparently, we don't find that in the book of Luke, or in the book of Acts. Luke has not told us that Paul preached that here in Ephesus, but he apparently had. Luke, of course, does not record everything that goes on. He would have a book, he'd need a wheelbarrow to carry the book of Acts around. But he's given certain things to suit his purpose, telling what happened. He didn't say anything about that. So it's not recorded by him that Paul preached this, but no doubt Paul had. And so he's saying, these people, these idols that are made with hands are not gods. I remember in class one day with Dr. Unger. He was the Hebrew man. And I translated the passage. It says it's God really making fun of the heathen, saying they'll cut a tree down, and with part of the tree they make a god, and the other part they cook their food. Words to that effect. And it's a strange thing to take, cut a tree down and you can you make firewood out of part of it and you make a god out of another part. How do you do that? Well, because gods are not, made hands are not really gods. And so this, the true God then is not made with hands. So there is a threat not only to the riches, but to the religion. And Paul is saying then that Diana is not a god, either with a capital G or a lowercase g. She's no god at all. She is nothing. So, of course, that roused them up. In verse 27, he says, not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into the disrepute, but also the temple. The temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worship. So now it's their riches and it's their religion, but now this whole temple. And if the temple goes down, the silversmiths go down. And if the silversmiths go down, then the people go down. You know, it's all, you can't have one without the other. And as, now, then as now, the people vote their pocketbooks. This is affecting us. I'm having trouble making a living. I'm going to get away from these people. And so they begin this riot. So that was the objection of the craftsmen. Now, the commotion of the craftsmen, how it started, verse 28. Now, when they heard this, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." And they said that many times. That's how the thing started. Great is Diana of the Ephesians. You know, every political rally needs a slogan. You know, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." You can't have a riot, you can't have a mob without some kind of a slogan. Tippecanoe and Tyler too. How's your American history? Way back, the 9th president of the United States, his slogan was "Tippecanoe and Tyler too." Go to eBay and you can check it out. 5440 or fight. How about that one? 5440 or fight. The Oregon Territory won a line through there, fighting with Canada back and forth, and that means the British. And so this one's saying 5440 or fight. Then there was one, I remember this one. Don't remember those two. I remember this one. "I like Ike." Remember that? Oh, pal. "I like Ike. I like Ike." That's their slogan. "I am not a crook." That wasn't a political slogan, but I couldn't resist it. "I like it." "Yes, we can." That's one. And that was it. "Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Yes, we can." That's the thing. There's another one. "Taxed enough already." That's another slogan of a group. So that's the Tea Party, of course. So the people chant this with a glazed eye, and then with the remembering the slogan, you know, they keep on remembering. What's that slogan now? "Well, yes, we can. Yes, we can." And they go into the voting booth and they say, "What was the slogan? Yes, we can. Oh, yeah, I'll vote for him." Yeah, that's it. Not that much. The slogan is very important to these people as well. And it works so well that people just keep following, following, and following. That's how it started. And then the way it swelled, the arrest of Paul's friends in verse 29 says, "And so the whole city was filled with confusion and rushed into the theater with one accord, having seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, Paul's travel companions." So Gaius and Aristarchus were not mentioned up until this point. I thought, where did they get? It's acted like they, "Oh, yeah, we know about these people." Nothing about that. I've checked all around. That's the first time they're mentioned in the book of Acts. So we now learn that they were traveling companions of Paul. Aristarchus, we learn from later on in verse 4 of chapter 20, that Aristarchus was from Thessalonica, and Gaius was from Derbe. Well, here they are. In fact, Aristarchus later becomes a prisoner with Paul in Rome, according to Colossians 4:10. So here are these men who are, they grabbed them. They're going to put them in jail or do whatever they want with them. So that's the arrest of Paul's friends. Now, then we have the attempt of Paul to fight with them or fight for them in verse 30. And when Paul wanted to go to the people, the disciples would not allow him. And then some of the officials in Asia, some of the leaders in Ephesus, who weren't believers, they weren't disciples, they were separate. These people that Paul had made friends with, he also said, oh, don't go in there. They sent messengers saying, pleading with him, saying, don't go out there, Paul, don't do it. So Paul was no coward. If they want me, they can have me. What part of me do you want? I can see him doing it now. Little old Paul, that's him. He wouldn't allow others to take the brunt of this rage that was meant for him. So he was going to do it. And strangely enough to me, that the officials, not believers, they're leaders in the city, and Paul was friends with them. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with making friends in high places. Make friends wherever you can, because you'll get the gospel to them later. And I think that maybe we'll see that they did do that. But we don't need to shy away from them. You know, James talks about when the rich people come into your assembly, that you push them up. You don't want to do that. But you don't want to shun them either. They also are people for whom Christ died. And so Paul had friends there. And they were saying to Paul, don't go in there. So these are the more educated people. They were not swayed by the religious opinions and the hysteria of these masses. And they saw the pagan religion was morally bankrupt. It was really in bad shape. And on the other hand, the Jewish people, the Jewish religion, had some aspects that were repugnant to them as well. So when Paul came along, Paul said, no, the law's done away. And Paul, very educated himself, was able to talk to these people. And listen, the Bible, the Christian religion from the Word of God, is a reasonable thing. You have no problem with with an educated person if he'll read the Word, if he'll listen. You can talk to him right from the Word. So Paul had those kinds of people as well. And they said, Paul, don't go out there. So he didn't. So there was the rest of the arrest of Paul's friends and the attempt by Paul to fight. Then the arrogance of Paul's foes, 32 to 34. In verse 32, we see their mob-like character. Some therefore cried one thing and some another, for the assembly was confused, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Isn't that just like a mob? They don't know why they're there. They want to smash some windows and steal some jewelry. They don't care about why they're there. And they're drab lives. You know how their lives were. They worked from sunup to sundown for 2 drachma or whatever. And here's excitement. And so, what's the crowd for? I don't know. Let's go in and holler. Huh? Well, that's what they did. So they were mob-like, a typical mob. Then there's a mechanical chant in 33 and 34. They drew Alexander out of the multitude, and the Jews putting him forward. Now, Alexander is a Jew, remember. Alexander motioned with his hand and wanted to make a defense to the people. When Paul was in prison, he wrote to Timothy, who was in Ephesus, and he warned him against Alexander, the coppersmith, who did us much evil. And then in 1 Timothy, he also mentions an Alexander who made shipwreck of the faith, and I handed him over to Satan, he says, in 1 Timothy 1, 19 and 20. So this could easily have been that person. He may well have become a believer and then reneged on the faith, and Paul had to deliver him to Satan. It may not have been. Alexander is not exactly a strange word. So in verse 34, though, then they found out that he, Alexander, was a Jew, With one voice, they cried out for about 2 hours. Get that? 2 hours they cried out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." 2 hours of that, you know? And then, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." So that was the reason for the riot. That's how they got going. Now, the ruin of the riot was in verse 35 to 42. There was a word of correction. The city clerk praised Diana. He said, and when the city clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, "Men of Ephesus, what man is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple guardian of the great goddess Diana and of the image which fell down from Zeus? Therefore, since these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing." Well, the city clerk, of course, was not just a clerk. He was the executive officer. It's like the city manager of a city today. He was an important executive. So he came out and he placated them quite a bit. He said, his point was that everyone knows that the Ephesians are guardians of this great goddess Diana. Everybody knows that. Why are you worried about one or two people saying you're not? Well, everybody knows you are. So nobody can deny that. You don't have anything to prove. Or as Shakespeare might have said, "Methinks thou protestest too much." You're not really sure of it yourself, you know. So don't do that. So the city clerk, he praised Diana first. And then he pinpointed Demetrius. Now, "For you have brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of your goddess." These men haven't robbed your temples. They haven't blasphemed your religion. They're not the problem here. These people are not your problem. Mobs often go off, they get the wrong party. You've seen it in the horse operas where the mob gets together, they grab a guy and they take him out and hang him. And whoops, that wasn't the right guy. Whoops, sorry. that happens. Get the wrong one. They become judge and jury of the whole thing. Well, that's what these people were doing. Paul hadn't done them any harm, but they were concerned about what he was preaching. Therefore, verse 38, city clerk says, "Therefore, if Demetrius," who started this whole thing, "if he and his fellow craftsmen have case against anyone, the courts are open to them. There are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another, and if you have any other inquiry to make, it shall be determined by lawful assembly." Demetrius needs to become more lawful. He needs to do it through the courts. There's plenty of room for that. So that's his word of correction. Now his word of caution in verse 40 and 41. "For we are not in danger of being called in question for today's uproar, there being no reason which we may give to account for this disorderly gathering." And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. Well, why were they ready to be dismissed? Well, because he had told them, be careful. Ephesus was a free city. Rome did not bother them. They governed themselves. But Rome gave them permission to do that. And as long as everything was going great, then no problem. But if Rome finds out you're having a disorderly thing here, this mob rule, if Rome finds that out, you're in trouble. And they can come in and take our freedom away, and we'll go back like any other city with Romans all around us. We don't want that. That's why he could dismiss the assembly. And by the way, that word, assembly, you know what that word is? Ecclesia. Oh my. It's a church. So people get that idea. The reason I mention that is in Acts 19, verse 38, the King James Version says that the Israel was the church in the wilderness. And I've read commentaries, I've read theologies that say, look at that. Israel was the church was in the wilderness. So the church and Israel are the same thing. on that kind of flimsy, silly talk, they have made the case for Israel and the church being the same thing. They are not. And the word assembly simply means the congregation, or the assembly is a good way to say it. Every time that word appears, you could say, it's the assembly. And how do you know which assembly it is? Context! That's right. Context. I know you don't want to speak out as a Baptist church. It might split the ceiling. Yeah, it's context has to tell you. If we find out it's the church of believers, if it's an assembly of believers, it's the church. If it's talking about an assembly of believers around the world, it's the church. But if you find this assembly of worshipers of Diana of the Ephesians, it's not a church. It's an assembly. Yeah. Or if it's Israel in the wilderness, it's not the church. It's an assembly of a congregation in the wilderness. That's all it is. And your later versions will say that, I'm sure. All right, so that's the reason for the riot and the ruin of the riot. He finally called them to attention there. And then the result of the riot. Chapter 20 and verse 1. After the uproar had ceased, Paul called the disciples to himself, embraced them, and departed to go to Macedonia. So he parted with his friends. I like this idea, he embraced them. You know how men are, you know, I'll shake your hand, don't get near me. men don't want to embrace men. He embraced them. And then he departed. He wanted to leave, and this incident probably gave him impetus to do more, to go. So he left. And he was going to pursue his plans. He had a six-month plan, remember? He wanted to go back to Corinth. And he's about to be able to do that. Now for the large sheet. The large sheet that's in your bulletin. Open it up. And there's a map on the screen. Boy, that's hard to see. Remember, here it is. There's Ephesus right here. Okay, and Paul is going to go to Corinth, but he's not going to go to Corinth this way. He's going to go to Corinth this way because he wants to visit these people. He wants to go up here to Troas and to Philippi and on down. He wants to go through there, and we'll see why. He wanted to do that in just a minute. Now, Paul had written a previous epistle. He hadn't written 1 Corinthians yet, but he wrote one before that. Paul wrote 4 Corinthian epistles. The first one, he says while he was in Ephesus, he wrote one. Paul had written this earlier epistle, and it's not recorded in the book of Acts. So he wrote an epistle from Ephesus over to Corinth, and he sent somebody over there with it. We don't know whom. But so that was while he was there, and no mention of it. So he did that. And then, because he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9, he says, I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. Now he's writing that in 1 Corinthians. So there is a Corinthians previous to 1 Corinthians. You see that? That's in 1 Corinthians 5, 9. So he wrote a previous epistle. But he also made a previous visit. He had made a visit to Corinth, not recorded in Acts. Now, look at 2 Corinthians 12, 14. You see it there. He says, now for the third time I am coming to you. As far as Luke told us in the book of Acts, he's only been there once. But he says in 2 Corinthians, this is the third time I'm coming to you. Well, he's been there before. He's been there twice before. So there was another visit from Ephesus over to here. Probably he just went over there because of some problems, went over there, straightened them out, came back over here, and continued working in Ephesus. I think that's the idea. So, and he also says in 13:1, this will be the third time I'm coming to you. So Luke recorded only one of those up to this point. Now, he had also written 1 Corinthians. Now, I'm telling you this because it's very important to see, because Luke doesn't give us much information here. But this is important for us to see. He wrote 1 Corinthians, and he sent Titus from Ephesus over to Corinth with this epistle. And then he told Titus, I'll meet you up here in Troas. And I'll be coming this way, you go this way, and we'll meet together in Troas, because I want to find out how they took that first epistle. Now, why is that important? Think about this. I've given you a list of the things that Paul covered in 1 Corinthians. Remember, Titus took the epistle over to Corinth, and Paul went on up there. He's expecting to meet Titus, and Titus can tell me, how did they take that drubbing I gave them? Because it was that. He scolded them for many things, as you remember. And he taught them some important doctrines. But the scolding comes, divisions in the church. He says, you're babies. Some of you say, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Peter, I'm of Christ. And you're acting like children, see? So he probably thought after he wrote it and Titus has gone down somewhere, he said, should I have said that? Well, that's tough. Mean. Well, divisions in the church. Moral disorders. One of you even has his father's wife. Wow. And he's bringing that out before the whole crowd? No. So marriage, they were having problems with marriage and whether it should be divorced and remarried and all that kind of thing. Should you keep your daughter not married? Don't let her marry? Is that more spiritual? Food offered to idols. He told them how to handle that. Don't do that. Do this, you know. And then the public worship. Veiling. Women should be wearing veils over their heads when they worship. The Lord's Supper. And their misuse of that. Remember, the people come in there and some were eating, some were starving. And they said, that's wrong. We talked about that first Sunday of the month. The use of spiritual gifts, especially the misuse of tongues. He really laid it out on them. You know? And then he also taught them the resurrection. Now, I say all that, I spend that much time to remind you, this was a scathing letter that he sent first to in 1 Corinthians, sent it by Titus over there. So, in this segment of the third missionary journey, Luke covers it in just one verse. One verse? He says, and that's in verse 2 of the next chapter, said, when he had gone through these districts and given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. That covers his whole trip. One verse, when he had gone through here and given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. That's it. That's all Luke says. We learn more from other places, and I think we ought to put this in here now. 2 Corinthians gives us some other detail. It gives further information about Paul's stop at Troas for the evangelistic purposes and of his desire to see Titus for a report on the Corinthian epistle. Subsequently, Paul went to Macedonia as he wanted to, 19:21, and he met Titus, and then he wrote 2 Corinthians. Now, how do I know that? 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. Furthermore, when I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel, and the door was opened to me by the Lord, I had no rest in my spirit, because I did not find Titus my brother, but taking my leave of them, I went to Macedonia. Now, I had in 2 Corinthians 5:7-7, he says, for indeed, when we came to Macedonia, our bodies had no rest, but we were trembling, troubled on every side. Outside were conflicts, inside were fears. Nevertheless, God, who comforts the downcast, comforted us by coming to Titus, by the coming of Titus, and not only by his coming, but also by the consolation with which he comforted in you, when he told us of your earnest desire, of your mourning, of your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced even more. What's he saying? He's saying, when I got up here to Troas, and I wanted to preach the word. In fact, he says, you notice, he says, God opened the door for me to preach. And I was so worried, so overcome with my problem with the First Corinthian letter, I couldn't do it. The Lord opened the door and said, okay, go in there and preach. And he said, I can't do it. What? Later on in Romans, he's going to write that in Corinth within the next three months. He says, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, those who are called according to his purpose. Everything works together for good. I don't have to worry about that. You know. But he hadn't learned that here. If he did, it's strange. But he gets up here. He can't preach. I can't preach the gospel. So he went on over here. And apparently what he's doing, he's following these churches. Remember the second journey? He went to different churches. He went to Philippi, Thessalonica, Derbe, and so forth. And he preached in Berea. And he preached there. So I think he's going from church to church. He said to Titus, meet me in one of those churches. Troas, but he figured Titus is going to come up through all these places. So he finally, when he got to Macedonia, somewhere in here, he found him. See? So when he found him, the fears were over. By the way, just as I am, one of the verses I think came right from this. Just as I am, though tossed about with many a conflict, many a doubt, fightings and fears within, without. I just corrected your hymnal. The original was fightings and fears within, without. Not fighting within and fears without. It doesn't fit. Charlotte Elliott was looking at this passage, I'm sure, when she wrote that. It's reversed in our hymnals. Anyway, that's what I think he's talking about. Fighting within, fears without. Fighting and fears within, without. See? And he said, that's where he was. I can't do it. I can't preach. Well, the message finally got out. He went to there. He found Titus along in here somewhere. And he was so overjoyed, he said. Remember? He was overjoyed that they accepted it. They mourned about it. They were really wanting to see Paul. And so Paul sat down there and wrote 2 Corinthians. Telling them how grateful he was and so forth. And he sent Titus on with that, on down. Titus, you take this on down here to Corinth. Read that to them. And I think he's still a little bit shaky. You know? Make sure they understand that I know and I appreciate their mourning and so forth, that they accepted that first epistle, and I'll come along later. You get them settled down and I'll be there. So then he went on down, came to Corinth, and in Corinth he stayed there about 3 months, wrote Romans while he was there, and then went on back. So I took a lot of time to do that, and I hope you understand that that's important for us to understand what happened in that little stretch of thing, what Luke covered in one verse. Well, why do you talk about all of this? Well, Luke talks about all this. It's there in the Word. But more than that, because we can learn from this. Persecution comes. And when persecution comes, what do? Well, we can learn from this passage some lessons. Here they are. First, this world is not a friend to grace to lead us on to God. Not at all. This world is going to stifle that. The world lies in the hands of the wicked one, and the wicked one is set to slay the gospel and to slay the people who preach the gospel. That's what he's after. This world is not a friend to grace. Don't expect it. And if a law is made, you can't do this and you can't do that, don't worry about it. You know? Do what you can do. If they take this away, do something else. If you can't talk about it, write about it. Do whatever you can. If you can't do it in public, do it in private. This world is not going to keep us from giving the gospel out, but we need to understand that they're not our friends. All right, that's first. When we preach the word, people will either get mad or glad. The gospel helps some people and it hinders others. The gospel is to, we're going to give the gospel out, and whichever way it goes, the people you have a problem with are the ones who are not either glad or mad. They're not listening. They're not hearing what you're saying. And we need to be preaching the word and Make sure they understand it. If they get glad, fine. If they get mad, fine. We'll do what we can. Fourth, here's one I like. The leader does not always have to be out there taking the heat. Understand that. The leader doesn't have to be out there. Some of you people can go, Gaius, Aristarchus, get out there. No. Well, that happens. You know, we'll all get some, is what I'm saying. Not only the leader, but we'll all get some. We can be sure of that. Now, five. We don't have to make enemies when we preach the word. You don't have to be mean about it. You know? We don't have to compromise the message to keep from getting people mad either. You know? We need to preach the word fearlessly, but we don't have to do it in a wrong way. I heard about a pastor. The church was looking for a pastor, and two men came candidating for the church, and they both preached on hell. And they both said, "You're going to hell." They called one and not the other. And someone said, "Why did you call him?" They both preached on the same thing. "Why did you call him and not him?" He said, "Well, they both said we're going to hell. But this one was sorry about it. That guy was glad of it. So we called the guy who was sorry about it." The guy who had compassion. You can preach the truth, but do it with compassion. And six, we need to treat people with respect, even when we disagree with them. You can convince somebody just as well with your hand on his shoulder and rather than a fist in his face. You know, we need to be agreeable in disagreeing. So later on, they may come in handy. You know, Hollywood has a slogan: "Be careful about the people you step on going up. You may meet them coming down." But that can happen. And then finally, be friendly to your neighbors. Go out of the way to help them or other people you come into contact with, your people you work with. We have to earn the right to give the gospel to them. So all of that, I think, is what we learn here in this passage. When persecution comes, be ready for it. It's coming. And don't be surprised by it.